I'd like you to open with me to a couple of places in your New Testament. We're going to be back in the book of Revelation this morning, and we will be looking at Revelation chapter 14, the first five verses. But as is our habit, we will also be looking at some other places. Life is hard in this age most of the time. That might hit you as a depressing thing to say. But on the other hand, it's not that depressing once you really look at it. What's depressing is to expect life to not be hard and then find out that it is. And unfortunately, our culture does precisely that. I'm going to move off camera for just a moment so that I can preach at all the sinners right over there. No, it's okay. Just kind of distracts me when I can't see you guys. You know, our culture will not tell you that life is hard. Our culture, Americans are very ill-prepared to deal with suffering. We've been pretty much taught that life ought to be pretty good. It might cost people in other parts of the world a lot to create products that we can buy cheap. But that doesn't bother us because life is really supposed to be pretty good, especially here. And so when tragedy strikes our personal lives, we are woefully unprepared for it. And very often when that occurs, we shake our fist at God and accuse him of not being a good president, whose job it is to make sure that we flourish, by our definition, in this age. Because of the fact that we're not well prepared for suffering, and we're not well prepared for persecution, we're not well prepared for difficulty, our faith in the Lord is often tested by precisely those kinds of things. And the Lord actually has a lot to say about it. And as much as it might sound like bad news, it's not. It's actually quite good news to know that the Lord actually said life is going to be hard in this age. But take courage, I have overcome this age. Shifting into the mindset of Jesus, into what we call kingdom think instead of world think, at first it's like, oh my, this is like really different way to think about life. But I promise you, it's a much better way to think about life. It enables you to enjoy everything you can enjoy in this age and not feel guilty about it, while at the same time not being terribly surprised when a lot of your life might hurt for a long time, or when a tragedy might strike your home, your family, yourself, by way of health or money or relationship breakdown or any one of a million things in a broken world that can go wrong. It doesn't surprise you then. You're not so shocked as if something, wow, what went wrong, that there's grief in my life, you see. If you think like Jesus, it enables you to enjoy that which is enjoyable and not be completely unseated when trauma strikes your life. And when we look into the book of the Revelation, actually, the Revelation is very much about dealing with suffering and trauma, especially specific persecution against Christians at the end of time, as God pushes evil all the way to the wall and then deals with it. But as the temperature increases during those last few years of Earth's history where the Lord talks about it, the intensity of it creates a world of constant violence and pressure. If you know the Revelation, you know that that's actually the promise. That's what Jesus said would happen. It will get worse before it gets better. When you see it that way, the Revelation is actually hugely hopeful. It was written to bring endurance and hope. We'll see this. We've seen it before. We'll see it again, where the Lord says that this is being written so that you can have endurance, so that you can bear up under dark times. And even though we're not in that last few years yet, we may be close to it. Who knows? But we still learn from it. So the Revelation really is very realistic, and it is excellent news, believe it or not. So what I want to start with, as we move, getting back into the flow of the book of the Revelation, from the standpoint that I just mentioned, the suffering that this world presses upon us and how the Lord answers it, I want you to begin in John chapter 16, in verse 31. John 16, verse 31, and then we're going to look at, what I'm going to do here is we're going to start with what Jesus says in the Gospel of John, then we're going to look at what Paul says in 2 Corinthians, and then we're going to look at the Revelation. And I want, again, I'm connecting the dots. That's a recurring theme around here. The whole Bible is one story. Every time you open it, you should listen for the voice of Jesus. And any time you teach or hear the word of God, you should be able to connect it with something in the life of Jesus. You belong to Jesus, and it is about him, okay? So that's why when I teach, I always start with something from what he says. And I want you to see in John chapter 16, it's, of course, right here at the end where he's just about to be crucified. He's with his men the night before the crucifixion. And they have, he has basically said that the Father loves you. The Father loves you because you love me, basically, is what he says in 25 to 28. And then in 29 to 31, the men say, oh, now we're starting to understand you. And Jesus says to them in verse 31, oh, really? Do you now believe? Behold, the hour is coming, indeed it has come, when you will be scattered, each to his own home. Now, he's facing the cross. He's facing the enemy's hour, which is also, oddly, the Father's hour. It looks like the enemy's going to win, but as it turns out, God had it all under control. And Jesus, in other places, does call this the enemy's hour. And yet, when you know the account, it is the enemy's hour, but it is also God's hour. Does that make sense? Does everybody kind of connect with that? Because when you expand that picture, what you have is the book of Revelation. It looks like the enemy's hour, but it's not really. God knows what he's doing, see? So the cross and the resurrection become the paradigm for understanding the book of the Revelation and understanding life in this age versus life in the next age. The cross is what it's all really about. The metaphysics of human history, the human experiment, so to speak, all hinge on the reality and the truth of the cross. You have a death and then a resurrection. And Jesus knows this. His men don't get it but he knows this. And so he says, there's going to come a time you're going to be scattered, each to his own home, and you're going to leave me alone. I'm not really alone. The Father is with me. Well, there would come a moment on the cross where he would cry out, my God, why have you forsaken me? But that's at this moment, the Father was tangibly with him. At the point at which he was on the cross, that sense was taken away from Jesus. By the way, that was taken away from Jesus so that it would never be taken away from you. I'm not alone, he says, for the Father is with me. I have said these things to you that in me you may have peace. In other words, when you think like I do, when you think along with me and you think the way I think, and you sense life the way I sense life. You come to me, you learn how to do this. You learn how to think in the kingdom. You belong to me by covenant. You let me give you my mind, the Spirit. When you come to me and you in me, you will have a peace. Paul calls it the peace that surpasses understanding. Doesn't come from understanding, it surpasses it. And so he says, in me, you will have peace. Shalom is the idea. Now and into the next age, in a world that doesn't have any shalom, that is really terrible, violent, dangerous, depressing world. He says, but in me, you'll have peace. In the world, you have tribulation. You will definitely have tribulation. You will definitely hurt in this world, he says. It's a promise. It's a guarantee. You will hurt in this world. But take heart or take courage. The Greek word can be rendered either way. Probably courage is even a little better. Take courage. I have overcome the world. Now notice three things here that Jesus says. First, the Father loves you because you love me. That is the one way to God. Come to his Son. Come to his Son. Come to Jesus. The Father loves you because you love me. In a human, it's not a perfect analogy, but did you ever notice that you have an easy time loving people who love your kids? And how do you feel about people who might abuse your kids? So now you know a little about the wrath of God, which we will discuss next week in the second part of Revelation 14 and so on. So this is, it's not a perfect analogy, but it's enough for us to get the emotional sense of what's going on here. The Father loves you because you love me. You've come into me. He says this in 25 and following of the chapter we just saw. Then secondly, he says, in the world you will experience pain and suffering. That's an absolute promise. And then third, he says, take courage, I've overcome the world. And it's a command to take courage. Take courage. It's a command. It's one word in Greek. It means let reach out and take hold of that which you know and live out the reality that God really loves you. And no matter what it looks like right now, no matter what you're facing right now, he knows what he's doing. Take the courage. It's like the Lord looks into your eyes and he says, it's not particularly happy right now, but take courage. Now see, he knows that the cross is coming and he knows these people are gonna have all their gears stripped. The people he's talking to are gonna have their lives crushed right in front of them. They're gonna lose everything because they bet everything on Jesus and they're gonna lose it all for 3 days. And then they're gonna get it all back plus eternity. But they don't get any of that yet. So he says, I want you to understand, it's a command, take courage now. Why? Why should we take courage, Lord? Is this just, you know, a motivational talk? No. It's because of a real historical fact. I have overcome all that causes the evil in this world. I've overcome the world. That's what he says. Take courage. I have overcome the world. Now, he hadn't gone to the cross yet, but it was a foregone conclusion that he would. And he knew, by faith he knew, that the Father was going to bring him back from the dead. He knew that by faith. He hadn't seen it yet. There was no dry run for that. Does everybody understand that? There was no dry run for the crucifixion and the resurrection. It had never been done before. So when Jesus gave up his spirit to the Father, as a human, he was trusting the Father to bring him back from the dead, exactly like you do, which is why he tells us to take courage. Now, it's been done once. So that's why you can actually, it's easier for you to take courage because it's already been done. And it's a foregone conclusion. I have overcome the world, even though at this point it hadn't been quite done yet, but it was, for all intents and purposes, done. He says, therefore take courage. If you leave the book of the Revelation on the burner for 2 days, do you ever leave something on a burner for 2 days? And you come back and look at it, when you open it up, all down at the bottom of the pan is John chapter 16, verse 33. Okay? If you get that, if you understand that the revelation is, in this world you will have tribulation, take courage, I have overcome the world. It's a 3-point outline for the entire book of the Revelation. And so what Jesus says to his friends is, take courage, life is hard, but I've overcome it. You got to look in the right direction. Now, let's turn to 2 Corinthians 11. Paul says, you belong to Christ, so stay true to him. When the pressure's on and the deceptions are great, stay true to him. Now, here again, this is reiterated in the Revelation. There's a reason the Revelation is at the end of the Bible, because it sums up all of the plot line of the Bible, and it stretches all the way back to Genesis with its allusions and its quotes. It ties it all together. It's perfect. The Revelation is, once you understand the symbolism of it, it's perfect. It ties everything together. And so Paul, in 2 Corinthians 11, says to Jesus' friends, which group had now expanded by the time Paul says these things, in verse 1, I wish you'd bear with me with a little foolishness of my own. He says, do bear with me. 2 Corinthians 11, 1. Verse 2, now, I feel a divine jealousy for you because I betrothed you to one husband to present you as a pure virgin to Christ. But I am afraid that as the serpent deceived Eve by his cunning, your thoughts or your mind, same Greek word, might be led astray from a sincere and pure devotion to Christ, loyalty to Christ. I'm afraid, he says, I betrothed you, marital language, this is marriage language. I betrothed you to one husband, Christ, to present you as a pure virgin. Now, what I want to point out here is, and you'll see it again in Revelation, some of you read ahead in Revelation 14, and you know exactly why I'm quoting this verse. But what he does is he uses, as it all through the Bible, God's relationship with his people, he describes in existential terms, the way we experience it. He describes it as a marriage. Israel and the church described as the spouse of God, the wife. In this case, the betrothed. And this metaphor is used constantly of, and what it's supposed to do, what we're supposed to get out of that, is that this is both legal and existential. We experience it. It is intimate and powerful. Like marriage is the most intimate and powerful personal relationship, even though we break them all the time, and even though it doesn't work as well as it was designed to, obviously, in a broken world. Nevertheless, it was designed to be the most intimate, most powerful, but also legal and binding covenant relationship. And what God is saying is, that's the way you are with me. And so that's why he uses the concept of virginity to describe loyalty to the covenant. And so that a person who says, I don't want to just listen to God, I also want to listen to the other gods. I also want to sort of be an idolater. I mean, I know I belong to God, but I'm going to be a part-time, I'm going to have a hobby that, you know, I'm going to have an idolatry hobby on the side. Would be like having a consort on the side. It'd be like having an affair as far as God is concerned. And he uses that because that's the way it feels to God when people are not loyal to him, which is really the story of Hosea. So this is very, very important because it comes up again in the Revelation. And so the note that he uses the term virgin here, not in the sense of physical virginity, material virginity, but he uses it spiritually. It means absolute loyalty to only one husband, only one God, only one covenant, and not fooling around with regard to that. Now that this is huge in the book of Revelation because the Lord comes to his people and he basically says, you have to be loyal to me, not just because I deserve it, which he certainly does. But because to not be loyal to God and to what he says, to not be loyal to that is to deny reality. This isn't just like you've got these various options and God is just kind of grumpy and he wants you to do what he wants. No, no. There's only one mind that runs the universe. If you decide not to live according to the expression of his mind, you're not in reality and you're not in life, morally, ethically, materially. You're not in life. You're out of life. If you're out of his mind, if you're saying, yeah, I don't want to do it your way, there is no other way. You kidding me? There is no other way. It just doesn't exist. God's way is the way. So, what Paul says is, this loyalty is seen as a marital connection. And when you see that, when you see the word virgin, that's what it means. Now, when he calls in Revelation, when he calls his people to purity and virginity, that's what he's talking about, in addition to sexual purity in the material realm, obviously. But you got to understand that in Revelation, this image is picked up much more powerfully. Now, we've seen what Jesus says about this. We've seen what the Apostle Paul says about it. Let's go to Revelation chapter 14, and we'll see what the Lord says through John, the Apostle. And in the Revelation, the whole book of the Revelation, Jesus tells his friends, remember, to be courageous. It's going to get worse before it gets better. Paul tells Jesus' friends to stay true, be real virgins, so to speak. John, in the book of the Revelation, reminds Jesus' friends that the Lord's going to win. And, you know, basically, the Revelation gets that point across. The Lord is going to win. No matter what it looks like right now, no matter how your life feels, God is actually going to win. And he gets this across in the Revelation, just to get back up to speed here, with imagery and symbolism. And a lot of the symbolism we don't connect with very well, which is job security for me. So I'm glad to be able to teach about it. You can't just, most people in this country, in our language, can't just sit down, read the book of Revelation, and understand it. And the reason is he uses symbolism to get some things across. He's basically getting two things across through this. Of course, the Lord wins, but if you double-click on that, he basically does this by giving symbolic visions in two ways. One, what's going on that's invisible to you dimensionally. In other words, what's going on in the realm that you cannot perceive with any of your five senses or any instrument that you can create to perceive things. No microscope, no telescope, no piece of instrumentation or technology that you can create that will perceive and show you visibly what the spirit realm is like. But the book of Revelation pulls back the veil a little bit and shows what's actually going on behind the scenes. That's very, very important to understand. There are scenes in the Revelation that are put into symbolism that actually reveal realities that are currently taking place in the invisible realm. And if you don't have room in your worldview, in your metaphysic, your worldview, if you don't have room for the invisible reality, you really can't think well as a Christian. And that might be one of the reasons you have a hard time thinking like a Christian. And you would just become a moralist. You would just become a religious moralist if you don't understand that there's an invisible realm, God is at work in it, and it impinges on the material realm, and vice versa. So the Revelation does that. And when we look into these visions, especially in 12, 13, and 14 of Revelation, we have snapshots of what's going on in the spirit realm. But there's another way too, not just dimensional invisibility, but also temporal invisibility. Temporal invisibility means stuff you can't see because it hasn't happened yet. Temporal, time. So there's a whole history that has been written and hasn't happened yet. Did you know that? And you're going to live into it. It's weird, but time is actually happening in the future. You just can't see it. And it happened in the past, and you can't see that either. You only see your little moment. So in order to get a glimpse of the realities that are coming, the book of Revelation opens up a temporal portal through the symbolism to say, this is what's going to take place. People always say, you know, if the Lord would just show me something, you know, about the invisible realm, I'd be able to. Well, he does. And we don't believe him. So why should he tell us anymore? Or we then ask him other questions about it, and he says, I'm telling you all you need to know, but if you take hold of what I'm telling you, it will really give stability to your life, especially when you're suffering. So this dimensional invisibility through the symbolism, what's going on in the heavenlies and so on, and temporal invisibility, what will happen in the future? And we're specifically going to see one of those right now. In the Revelation chapter 14, verses 1 to 5, it is a vision of something that's going to happen in the future in which you are going to take part. You're going to actually be a part of what it is. So what's happening behind the scenes we see in Revelation, and how it's all going to end. And how it's going to end, you probably know, is God's going to kill all evil, and then he's going to bring the cosmos back to life. He's going to kill it and bring it back to life in purity. He's going to kill it with all the sin, dying with it. He's going to bring it back to life in purity and resurrection. He's going to kill it with all the sin. It'll be buried. Then he's going to bring it back to life in a new heavens and a new earth with a new king. Do I need to say it again? Do you get the paradigm of the cross here? Okay, now we live on this side of that paradigm, but that paradigm is exactly what history is all about. And so, Jesus says it's going to get worse before it gets better, but take courage, I've overcome the world. Paul says, be true, no matter what it looks like. You have been betrothed to the real king. Stay true to him. John, through the vision that Jesus gives him, tells us what's happening behind the scenes and how it's all going to end. And third, why you should trust Christ no matter what happens. Why? I just told you. Because God's intent is to destroy what's here, is all the evil in it, which, and if you destroy the evil in it, most of what we see in this age will actually come to destruction because the evil is so permeating in it. It's so endemic to the culture and to the world in its present state that when it finally reaches its final state, it will actually kill the world, and then God will bring it back. So that's the big picture of what's going on. If you can kind of grasp that, then maybe the feeling that you're dying, or there's a part of your life that's dying, or there's a part of your life that's being taken away from you, or there's a part of your life that doesn't feel as good as it used to, there's a part of your life that is bringing fear to you, then maybe you'll be able to see that as a Christian. If you're a Christian, you need to see that overlaid against this paradigm that I'm laying out here. And it will give you hope. That's how the book of the Revelation actually gives us hope. Now, chapters 12, 13, and 14 we'll zero in on. And this is an interlude after the seventh trumpet, which I won't go into. You can remember perhaps that there's a series of trumpets, series of seals, seal judgments, then trumpet judgments. After the seventh trumpet judgment, there is this interlude in the vision. And the Apostle John receives several snapshots that tell us the story that God is doing behind the scenes of human history. And in those snapshots, we start to pick up a little bit of what's really going on. And this is what I said. This is how the dimensional invisibility, he starts to reveal things. In chapter 12, if you'll remember, there's a drama and a war. You remember the drama? There was a woman who was giving birth to a child, and there was a dragon. You guys remember all that? And the woman gives birth to the child. The dragon tries to kill the child, doesn't get to kill the child. The dragon doesn't get to do what he wants. Let's put it that way. The child escapes and ascends to a throne, and then the dragon persecutes the woman. Do you remember what that story is about? That's the picture of the battle that is laid out behind the scenes in human history. The woman, the people of God, the covenant people of God. The child, the Messiah. The dragon, it says it right there in the text, Satan, who tries to stop the Messiah but can't. In fact, the Messiah actually turns destiny inside out by dying and coming back from the dead and ascending and taking over the universe. If this sounds too good to be true or it sounds like a fairy tale, listen, all the great fairy tales are based on the truth of this. All the great fairy tales, all the beleaguered minority that wins against the great evil majority, all the stories that where you have a small group of righteous people. From Star Trek to Star Wars to all the great stories. That's because this story is actually true. And what he says is this Messiah who was born and Satan tried to kill him has actually taken over the entire universe and is now altering destiny and moving it the way he wants it to go. This makes the dragon very angry. What does the dragon do? He can't reach the kid anymore. So he goes after the people who gave birth to the child and to their offspring, which is the people who belong to Christ. That's the woman in the second half of the story. Am I going too fast? Okay. Second half of the chapter, the dragon, it says very clearly the dragon simply makes war. It says his time is short and he makes war against the people. Now, as time comes to an end in this era, that's the intense story. How does the dragon do this? He cannot give himself any more time, and he can't stop what God is going to do, and he knows it. He knows he's doomed. So what does Satan do? He tries to cause as much damage on the earth as possible. How can he do that? By acquiring the worship of the earth to himself, because he knows he's doomed. He can take them with him. He can't save himself. He doesn't even want to. He doesn't even want to save himself. He hates God. He hates God's plan. He doesn't want to save himself. But he can take as many of God's people with him as possible, meaning human beings in general. He can take humans created in God's image by deceiving them and taking them with him. And that's exactly what he does. And he can persecute the people who already can see him, who already are in the light. He can persecute them. He can't have their souls, but he can make life very hard on them. Is this making sense? And that's the second half of chapter 12. That's what chapter 12 of Revelation is about in the symbolism. If you double-click on that, chapter 13 pops up, and what you see is two beasts, which are two leaders, and that's how the enemy actually, that's how Satan actually does it, through two elements. One is the Antichrist, the beast from the sea. The Antichrist, who is the beast from the sea. And the other one is the false prophet, who is the beast from the land. Now, if you're saying, man, you're going too fast for me, I'm losing it here, go back and get the tapes or the CDs from those studies, because I went into it in depth. But what happens is that Antichrist, that world ruler, is the person, the first beast in chapter 13, actually is the personification of human evil and idolatry. He becomes everything human beings are without God, okay? Let me remind you what he is. He has a character that does motivate, but it is evil. He motivates people through anger, hatred, and selfishness. The motivation that he uses, you'll see it, is anger, hatred, and selfishness. That is the motivation in the human soul, and this is how he functions. People who want to hate, people who want to live strictly for themselves, are going to love this guy. So his character motivates, but it's evil to the core. His authority is over the whole world, but not over time. You see this in the passage too. The Antichrist has authority to press the people of God and to deceive the people who don't belong to God. But he doesn't have authority over time. He can't. His time is short, it says. The dragon's time is short. So he doesn't have. Never worship a god that doesn't have control of time. And there's only one God who has control of time. And time is an amazing dimension. It's an amazing thing. You think you know what it is, but I dare you to describe it. It's very hard to understand time. But God controls it. He created it, and he controls time. And that means he controls matter. And that means he controls the universe. Satan doesn't have that. He has authority. The Antichrist has authority, but not over time. Third, impressiveness that is able to inspire people, but focuses on the creation. The key to the Antichrist is what you need is here and now. This world, this thing, this fruit, Eve, this stuff, O King, this world can give you what you want. That's his hallmark. That's his calling card. So he inspires, but his inspiration focuses on this age. And fourth, he has the power to kill, but he cannot make life, can't create life. He can kill, but he can't create life. Now, did you catch those? That's the description of humanity, is it not? Character that motivates but is evil, authority over the world but not over time. You can have some power in the world but not over time. Impressiveness that can inspire but focuses only on this creation, and power that kills but can't bring life. That is a description of human life and human culture outside of God. Without God, that's what we're looking at. The Antichrist is the personification of the rebellion of humanity. He's a real person, but the reason he will be so popular is because there's something that resonates from within the heart of man. Yes! Why do they like it? Because it's self-worship. It's actually, he's the God we would invent. He'll be powerful. He'll be beautiful. He will give wealth. He'll say, this age is your age. You can do whatever you want in it, long as you carry my mark. Long as you think the way I want you to think and live the way I want you to live, I want my number on your head and on your hand. You think my way, you work my way, I'll give you whatever you want. And humanity says, yeah, actually, I just feel right about doing that. I gotta be me. You know, I'll save you the joy of hearing the rest of that song. How much of our music, how many of our movies, how much of our stuff right now, today, is focused on human self-worship? You personify that, give it power and money, and you have something human beings will worship, if they aren't worshiping God. Okay. Then comes the second half of chapter 13, the false prophet who does miracles, and he says, now we will really worship this Antichrist. We'll make an image of him, and we will worship him. And you will see in the second half of 13, the false trinity, the dragon, the Antichrist, and the false prophet, imitating the real trinity. The false always imitates the true. The true never imitates the false. So you got a false trinity expressing false authority, false miracles, and a false law. They make up their own law. They don't need God. We have our own law. We make up our own laws. Let's not use God's law. Let's use our own laws. False law, false authority. It doesn't originate in God's mind. It originates in the mind of man. They have their own law. And that law then promises a false fulfillment, which is success in this age. That's why you can't do business without the mark. See? Success in this age. Fourth, and that influences the worship of the false god. And that influence is a coercive influence. That's the mark of the beast. Now, if you remember, latter part of chapter 13, no one's allowed to do business or succeed. In other words, you can't succeed. If you want to succeed in this age, you have to think like the beast. And people say, well, what's the mark actually mean? The mark means thinking and acting from the inside out in accordance with the worship of the self as a human. The mark may be very well a physical mark, maybe, but it doesn't have to be. Remember what I mentioned last time in Deuteronomy chapter 6? God said, I want my word attached to your forehead and put on your hand. He says to his covenant people, put my word on your forehead and your hand. And everybody knows that it's not the physicality of where you write it. It's the fact that it's in your mind, it's in your thinking, it's your worldview, and it's in your actions. It affects how you are. That's how God says, you can tell my people, they think like me, they think in the kingdom, and they live that out as that's the real reality. And the enemy says, yeah, and you can tell my people because they do the same thing, except it's the reality based on this world and the worship of the self. So don't worry about the technology of the number of the beast and all that stuff. The technology is there to do it, but that's not the point of the passage. The point of the passage is what's in your head? What's in your head? And what's in your actions? How do you vote with your feet? If you say, I belong to Christ, but you actually live out a life that is essentially self-worship, that self-worship is essentially Antichrist before Antichrist is even on the scene. He's not here yet. But you see, we're being prepared. Our whole world is focused on the self and not on the kingdom. Everything that's advertised to you, almost everything that's advertised to you is advertised under the idea that it's good for yourself. So just be aware that this mentality is, this idolatry is alive and well in our world, alive and well. And all it needs is a person to come and say, I'm in charge of it. And the whole world will say, yes, and we can make money at it, see. So you end chapter 13 with the beast and the number. And the number is the number of a man, it says, which can also be translated the number of humanity. 666, number 6 is the number of humanity, incomplete. 7 is the number of completion and the number of God. The number of 6 in the Bible always represents incomplete humanity. So 666, this is the God of incomplete humanity. Whatever else he is, he's the God of incomplete humanity. He's the God of humanity as a God. Okay, everybody take a deep breath. All right, have we gone too fast? Are you sitting here going, I can't believe I've been drinking from a fire hydrant for the past 40 minutes. I got more on me than in me. The notes, these notes will be on the internet. They'll be on the internet, so don't worry about it. But I gotta bring you up to speed because you will not get chapter 14 until you see it as a contrast. It is the joyous, marvelous, bright, light, excellent contrast to the darkness of the evil of this age that is personified in the false state religion, the false prophet, the Antichrist, all that. This next vision is this awesome look at what God's really going to do and who's going to win. In this vision, chapter 14, 1 to 5, it tells who's actually going to win this war. It looks like the enemy's going to, he outnumbers everybody. He's got the power. He's got the glory on earth. He's got everything, and it looks like he's going to win, but he's not going to. And so this vision in 14, 1 to 5 is a look for all the people who are facing dark times. It's a look past those dark times into what it will really be like when the Lord sets up his kingdom. And it's visionary. It is symbolic. See if you can pick up the symbolism. I looked, said John, and behold, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb. In contrast to the beasts, these fearful, fearsome beasts, you've got this Lamb who is the king, you know who he is. And with him, 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads, not the number 66, not the thinking of the world, not the thinking of the self, not the worship of humanity, but the name of Christ and the name of God is on their heads. That means they are thinking in a whole different worldview. And I heard a voice from heaven, like the roar of many waters, like the sound of loud thunder. That roar of many waters is the in the Mediterranean world would have been breakers crashing against the shoreline. You ever go watch storm surf on the Oregon coast? I love that. Watch the storm surf. You don't want to get too close, you know, but you stand there and you watch it. You don't just see it, you feel it. It's a sound that you feel. Yeah? Okay. That's what he sees, hears, experiences, the roar of many waters, like the sound of loud thunder, another sound that you feel. The voice I heard was like the sound of a harpist playing on, harpists, plural, playing on their harps. And they were singing, they, meaning the 144,000, were singing a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and before the elders, referring back to the vision in chapters 4 and 5, what's going on in the spirit realm. This worship with this incredible, powerful music is going on in the future. No one could learn that song except the 144,000 who'd been redeemed from the earth. So now you see they belong to the Lamb. They've been redeemed from the earth. You see that these are his covenant people. It is these who have not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. Now you see why I read to you from Paul first to avoid the throwing of things in my direction when I, because when you read this, it looks like, oh my stars, what's he, is he saying that women are evil? He better not be. No, he's not at all. What he's talking about is the same thing we talked about in 2 Corinthians 11. It's where the apostle, he's talking about a spiritual reality and a spiritual loyalty. They are virgins. It is these who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. Remember the song we sang this morning? I will follow. These who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb, and in their mouth no lie was found, for they are blameless. Let me mention some things. Just looking at this is an amazing thing. Let me mention some points about it, four specific points about it in our last 15 minutes together here. Here they are. I'm going to tell you four things, and then we'll see how it helps us to deal with hard times and suffering. But first, I want you to notice the place where they're standing. Secondly, the song that they sing. Third, the way they live. And fourth, the gift that they have. So first, the place where they're standing, which is with the Lamb on Mount Zion. So what is that about? What is he talking about with the Lamb on Mount Zion? Well, Mount Zion is where Christ rules in the Old Testament. When it prophesies when Christ comes, Mount Zion is the place that he stands and rules. It's the place where God says, I'm taking over now. You know that famous statue of raising the flag on Iwo Jima, you know? It's that look. And it's that feeling, too. I mean, I wasn't even alive when that took place. But if you listen to music and you look at that statue and you get a feel for what all that means, it's much more than just a picture of something. It means something powerful that that flag was being raised. And it means huge, huge sacrifices were made in order for that flag to be raised, you see. Zion is that. It is that picture where God says, huge sacrifice on my part, says God, in order to take over this incredibly evil place and straighten it out and heal it. That's Mount Zion. And notice that the place where these people stand is right there with him. And that's you. You say, well, am I one of the 144,000? Yes and no. The number is absolutely, definitely symbolic. The question is whether it's also literal. And Christians debate this, whether it's literal 144,000, maybe Jewish people, or whether it represents a larger group because it's 12 times 12, which is very symbolic numbering, and Revelation has a lot of symbolism in it. I'm not going to get into that argument. I really don't care, because there's no question that what we're supposed to see here is Jesus and his people are standing at the point of victory. So that no matter what it looks like right now, God is actually going to win. That's what is being said here by where they're standing. The coming reality is that because of the fact that God has put his mind in you, because his name is on you, you're going to be among those people who stand with Christ at the end of time and say, yes, the evil has been defeated. And you're going to do more than that. You're going to be singing. Now, I know it's hard for us to imagine. Is it hard? Do you have, if you have little kids or grandkids maybe, and you try to explain to them what it's like to be an adult, do you notice they don't get it? They just don't get it. They say, well, why do you do this? Why can't we do that? Why do we, you know, can't I, you know, I want to think for myself. No, dear, you really shouldn't. Well, why? Why? You know, well, because, you know, I'm 50 and you're 10. And if you want to live to see 11, you really shouldn't think for yourself. You'll die if you don't let me show you how to think, because you just don't get it. You just don't know. Here's the way the future looks, we say to our children. Again, it's an imperfect analogy, but I want you to get a little of how real it is for us even talking to children. Or if you were to go back in time, 100 years, exactly 100 years back in time, and you were talked to, say, physicists who were discovering quantum physics 100 years ago right now, and the laws of general relativity, which are now very common, taught to junior high kids, for heaven's sake. And Einstein was just starting to figure it out exactly 100 years ago right now. And you were to go back, and you were to try to explain to them what the future holds, nobody would believe you. But that doesn't mean it's not going to happen. Now, the reason Jesus reveals this to John in symbolic form is so that people of any generation, once they understand the symbolism, can say, that's where I'm going. That's actually where I'm going. And can grasp it and hang on to it. And you must. Christian friend, listen, you must grasp the fact that you're going to win because you're standing with the Lamb on Mount Zion. You're already there. You're already there in the future. You just can't see it. And that's why it's based on that that the Lord Jesus says, you must endure now because you're already there. So keep your mind on that. That's why he reveals this, to give hope to people facing horrible persecution under the beasts and to give strength to us for very similar reasons. You've got the Father's name and the Son's name. That's identity, protection, union, possession. You've got a whole mindset that says, this is my reality. I live in that reality, that future reality. Man, that's an amazing way to live. The place they stand, the song they sing, that's a shared, profound joy. The new song, it says it's a new song, and it's a song only they can learn. I wish we had time to go into this more, but music is powerful, absolutely powerful. And this music is so loud and so powerful that it literally shakes the very creation. That's the sound that he's trying to describe, and yet it's vocal. There's this vocalization in it that is so powerful that it just shakes everything. You ever been to a rock concert or any kind of concert, but it doesn't have to be a rock concert, where the music literally moved you from the inside? Do you know that no other creature does that? Angels may, but no creature in this material realm can do that. Only human beings can make that kind of music. And when they come in, it alters the way they think. It alters the way you feel. You've been in music, in situations, sometimes worship, where it's just so overwhelming, for good or for ill. Sometimes I've been to some rock concerts I don't even want to tell you about for fear I would lose credibility. And the music actually moves your spirit and shapes it from the inside out in a certain way. Well, this powerful music that these people are singing is called a new song. Now you say, well, what's that about? In the Bible, where new songs are mentioned in the Old Testament, mentioned several times, they're always songs written after God has made some sort of huge deliverance and rescued his people, and it deserves a new piece of music. And in one case, God wrote the music and gave it to Moses, which means God is a composer. And it wasn't just so that they would remember it. It was because the ability to sing it, the ability to play it, the ability to join it together speaks into the person and comes out of the person in such a powerful way. That's why we worship here. That's why all churches, almost all churches, sing, and why God commands singing, second only in commands in the Bible, second only to the command to pray is the command to sing. Did you know that? Over 100 times in the Old Testament, close to 100 times in the Old Testament, the command, sing, 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 sing. Why? Well, and we're going to be doing it here in the future in a powerful way that will absolutely burst your consciousness. I mean, it is going to expand your mind majorly to be at this scene, because God will have done such a deliverance that what will spontaneously erupt is a new song that the people who understand and have been redeemed can sing. People who understand and have been redeemed can actually write it and sing it, and the angels will have to listen. That's amazing. That is absolutely amazing. By the way, the worship time that we have here before the Bible study is not optional. I don't know if you know that, but some folks just come in after the music, and they go, it's just the singing. Like the singing is some sort of warm-up just for the Bible study. That's not true. If you never join in, you say, well, my voice is no good. That's why we do it together. It's sort of a mutual fund of worship. You know, like we stick it all together and then we invest it. You know, so, you know, sing softly. But if you haven't actually become a part of praise and worship, you think it's an optional thing. Friend, it is not optional. It's an emotive experience, even now in this age, that will lift your spirits, that will strengthen you, and will strengthen the people around you. And in this coming age, notice these people are singing. Why? It's a new song. Why? It's because, as in keeping with the Old Testament, God has done this incredibly powerful deliverance so that they come out of it and they're like, wow! And they begin to sing. Did anybody see the thing at Macy's that was on the internet where they had that choir from Philadelphia? I think the Philadelphia Philharmonic, one of those. And they came down and infiltrated the mall at Macy's in New York. And it was done at other places too. And on cue, they all started to sing the Hallelujah Chorus. But they weren't lined up like a choir. They were just around with everybody else. And you couldn't tell who the, until they started singing, and you looked for the little buttons they were wearing, you couldn't tell who was, who were the people who started it all. But one person started, and pretty soon you've got these voices. You should have seen the, if you haven't seen it, you can still probably find it on YouTube. But to watch the people looking around at this, the Hallelujah chorus, which is amazing, and in this multi-level kind of worldly place, you know, Macy's, you know, and the reactions of the people listening to this music, and some of them would join in, and it just lifted that whole thing. It brought tears to your eyes. It was amazing. And that's just in a mall. What we're talking about here is the universe, and you're at the center of it. You're at the center of it. You're the choir for this. This is practice, what we do here for this. So why ruin your voice in this era, considering we have this to look forward to? So the song they sing, the way they live, loyalty to Christ, virgins, apprentices, and living sacrifices. Virgins meaning, hey, I am not going to worship another God. I am not going to let another worldview take over my life. Apprentices, following the Lamb wherever he goes. A disciple is an apprentice. You learn to think like Jesus. You learn to do what he does. You learn to take seriously what he takes seriously, and you learn to not take seriously what he does not take seriously. That's following him wherever he goes. Apprentices, living sacrifices, first fruits redeemed. First fruits is a sacrificial term, and that means you actually belong to him completely. Loyalty, absolute radical loyalty, a life lived as a living sacrifice, Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. And then living in truth, loyalty to Christ, living in the truth. There was no lie in their mouth, it says. Why? It's because when you live in the truth, you tell the truth. And it's not just, you know, I honor my documents or I honor my promises. It's that. But it's living in a whole realm where truth-telling, you just learn to trust what God says. You learn to live in the light and not be dishonest. You learn to promote and live in a way that has integrity. And he says, this is the fruit. This is the fruit of belonging to this king. What's he contrasting with? The beast who is a stinking liar. That's who he's contrasting it with. The people who have the wrong number on their head, who lie for a living, not living in the darkness, not living in the light, living in the light, living with the Lord, you see. So the way they live, amazing. And finally, the gift they have, which is blamelessness. You go, it says they're blameless. And at the men's prayer breakfast, one of the guys said, what does that mean? How did they get, you know, where did blameless people come from? You know, I mean, these are human beings, right? These are real humans, right? And it says they're blameless. How did that happen? Well, remember, the place they stand, the song they sing, the way they live, and the gift they have. This blamelessness they have is a gift. See, how do we know that this blamelessness is a gift? It's because they are called the virgins, and they belong to the Lamb. What does that mean? Well, that means they're the bride of the king. Oh. And what does it say about the bride in Ephesians chapter 5? That they've been washed in the blood, and that's why they're blameless. It uses the same word, blameless. It means spotless, completely pure, but it's not the kind of spotlessness that comes from you trying hard. And that's what's so glorious about the good news. It's not because people who come to Christ try really hard to be good, try really hard to not lie, try really hard to be a virgin. You see, that would be misreading this. Instead, it is people who come and say, there's no way I can stop, Lord. There's no way that I cannot be a sinner unless I give my soul to you, and you then wash me in your blood. And that's exactly what he does for his bride. That's exactly what he does. You say, well, I'll tell you, and metaphorically and maybe materially, it's been a long time since I was a virgin, you might say to yourself. Can God love me? I mean, there's stuff that people sitting right next to you don't know about you, and you'd be horrified if they found out. You know that. And the Lord looks at you, and he says, I know it all. I've known it all along. And if you come to me, and some of you have, Most of you have, and some of you don't realize this about yourself, but when you come to him, he literally washes you in his own life, his own blood. His life washes you, completely cleanses you, so that he sees you as blameless. That's exactly what it says in Ephesians 5. That's what's true about this 144,000, symbolic of all of his people, and it's why you get to stand there. You don't stand there because you did good. You did do good, but you did good because he did something for you. This is a kind of blamelessness that is not from you, but it produces it in you. It's from him. It's his goodness. It's Jesus' own goodness given to you and his death on your behalf. You see, when you come into him and you become a part of the lamb, that's the whole lamb imagery that, from the Passover. When you're under that blood from the Passover, all these images, what happens is he gives you his own good record that he did on earth. He did it all. He did a perfect life the way you've been claiming that you did sometimes. He really did it so that you can say, oh, well, I give up. I'm going to let your record be over my life. And then he died for all the sins you actually really did commit so that both in his life and his death, he cleanses you. That is very good news. That is the news of the gospel. That's this king. That's this lamb. That's why he wins. And that's why you're going to be there with him. What an amazing message the gospel is. And you will not hear it in any other religion. This gift of blamelessness that ensures this life, this music, this lifestyle, this future, this only comes in Jesus Christ. It doesn't come in self-worship. It doesn't come in the pre-Antichrist stuff that's going on in our era right now. It's not offered by the world or any other religion. This is offered only in the good news of the gospel. If you are facing hard times, notice what he's saying here. Concentrate on the invisible realities, friends. Concentrate on the invisible realities. Secondly, focus past your own earthly death. You're going to live forever. Focus past your death. Do you ever notice when you focus on something in a distance, the stuff up close isn't quite as sharp a focus anymore? Okay, what he's telling his friends who are facing hard times is you have to focus in the distance, focus at the far end. You are actually going to live forever. You're not just going to have a few more years and then die, so you better get as much out of it as you can. I had a friend who took a tape measure, and he said, how long do you think you're going to live? And we picked by inches, let's say 80. That would be very hopeful for me. I probably won't live that long, but 80. Okay, we'll go to 80. How old are you now? 57 for me right now. Okay, he said, pull it over. That's how much you have left, he did. He said, now that's a very sobering thing to do. You pull that over and you say, well, that's all I got left. And that's if I live to 80. And that's very sobering, and it's actually a good illustration at times, but here's what I want you to do with that tape right now. I want you to straighten it out. I want you to lay it down in front of you, going away from you, and I want you to run the tape into infinity. All the way into infinity. I just want you to put a little red line at the 80 point. That is the way a Christian thinks. They think through their death, not stopping at death. They think through it, and they live their life now like they're going to live forever. That will change a lot of decisions. That changes a lot of things, and it also brings to light a lot of temptations. You go, well, that's not worth falling into. Why? I'm going to live forever. You got to live that way. That's what Jesus is saying. That's why he takes this thing that's way in the future, and he says, focus on this vision right here. And that'll help you when you're suffering, I promise. And finally, meditate on the cross. Meditate on the cross. Back to that paradigm we opened with. When you're facing hard times, what you have to do is realize that the cross is the paradigm of reality. The hard time comes first, but in Christ, guaranteed there is a resurrection. Guaranteed there's a point at which when you experience it, it will make everything evil that you've ever experienced nothing more than one bad night in a hotel. Teresa of Avila said that. One bad night in a bad hotel, that's the way all of human history is going to feel like once the Lord kisses you. She said, when he kisses you and he says, welcome, all the evil you've ever experienced will be like one night at a bad hotel. Elizabeth Elliot, in her excellent little book on suffering, said this: in Old Testament times, suffering was seen as evil. In the New Testament, suffering and evil are no longer identical. Think of the shock that the crowds must have felt when Jesus said that those who mourn, those who are poor and persecuted and have nothing, are happy. How could he say these things? Only in light of another kingdom, another world, another way of seeing this world. He came to bring life, another kind of life altogether. And it is in terms of that life that we must learn to look at our sufferings. I have found it possible, she says, when I see suffering from that perspective, wholeheartedly to accept it. But it takes a steady fixing of my gaze on the cross. Why? Because we're at this side of it. We're on this side of the cross, in a sense. I don't know where you are right now, my friend, but if you haven't given your life to Jesus Christ, I promise you he's the only hope. Open your heart up to him. Come to the real king of the real universe, who is going to win. He's already won. And who's going to rebuild this universe. And you're going to be a part of it if you'll come to him. Open your heart up. There'll be people here. They're standing on both sides, up here in the prayer room. All of us who are part of this body would love to help you give your life to Jesus Christ and become a Christian and become part of God's real plan. Open your heart up and give your life to him. Come up and talk to us about it. If you're a Christian and you kind of forgot some of this and you feel like my life is a mess, I can't go on, the important things in my life I've lost, whatever the case may be, you feel attacked from all sides, you feel like I just want to end it all, my friend, listen. This age is temporary. Jesus says you can hang on and you can hang in. He says, take courage now. Hold on to him. Heavenly Father, we pray that you'd strengthen us to these purposes because we live in a dark age. It is a suffering world and we suffer along with it. And we know you have suffered already and been victorious. So Father, would you infuse us with your mind and your spirit in these things and teach us insight and wisdom that we might face the traumas of this age as a witness to the truth of who you really are. We trust you for it. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. God bless you.